This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hulu. Based on shocking true events, the new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, tells the story of a savage murder in a small town. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays only on Hulu.
I'm Jesse Thorne. R.L. Stine is the creator of Goosebumps, the kids' horror books. He's written about ventriloquist dummies that come to life, haunted garden gnomes, and take it from our man Bob Stine. Inspiration can strike anywhere.
I came up with this book title. I'm walking along, Little Shop of Hamsters, which is a great title, right? So I had to do a book about it, but how do you make hamsters scary? That was a challenge.
From MaximumFun.org and NPR, it's Bullseye. This week, the Bullseye Halloween Spectacular. We've got more with R.L. Stine. We have Monet Exchange from Drag Race. Anna Fabrega from Los Espookies. All that coming up on Bullseye. Let's go. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My first guest in our Halloween Spectacular doesn't need much introduction. It's R.L. Stine. If you're my age or close to it, odds are you read one or two or 20 or 100 of his books when you were a kid. He has written over 200 Goosebumps books, sold millions of copies, inspired a TV show, two movies, and a video game. Now, Stine, as you are about to hear, can't resist a good title. Say Cheese and Die, Werewolf Skin, Go Eat Worms. We're basically just reading out of Wikipedia right now. And he has carried on that proud tradition with a new series, a compilation of short horror stories for kids, which he has titled Stine Tinglers. And as you're about to hear, R.L. Stine is, just as you would hope he would be, an absolute delight. Let's get into it. R.L. Stine, welcome to Bullseye. I'm so happy to have you here.
Well, thank you. My pleasure.
Did you read series books when you were a kid? Did you read Tom Swift or the Hardy Boys or something?
I found those old books. My father had them, and I found a bunch of them. But I didn't read books when I was a kid.
Not at all?
No. I read only comic books. I was a comic book freak. And so, I mean, I have all the wrong answers for these things. I should tell you about how much I loved children's books and how inspired I was. But no, I loved comic books. And, you know, when I was a kid, there were those incredible horror comics, Tales from the Crypt and The Vault of Horror. And they were just horrifying, gruesome, with wonderful art. And they were funny and scary at the same time. Those were very big influences on me.
Where did you get your comics?
At the barbershop. The barbershop had, this is a true story, the barbershop had a big stack of these horror comics. And one day I bought some and brought it home, and my mother wouldn't let me bring them into the house. She said, "These are trash. You can't have these." And so I used to go to the bar. I used to get a haircut every Saturday morning so I could read these comic books. I had less hair when I was a kid than I do now.
How old were you when you tried to bring them home?
9 or 10.
I mean, I'm impressed that the barber sold them to you.
Well, he didn't sell them. They just had, you know, for reading in the barber shop, they had a big stack of them. And I would just go. I just loved them.
You're like going down the line there. You're like Sports Illustrated, not interested. Playboy,
no.
Not for me. Horror comics, yes, please, thank you.
Right. But my friends and I all carried around big stacks of comic books. We used to trade them and read them under a tree in my front yard. And I didn't really discover books until I was about 10.
What books did you discover when you were 10 or 11?
Well, this is my librarian story, how a librarian changed my life. Okay? It's one of my few nice, really nice stories. I grew up in the suburb of Columbus, Ohio. And one day my mom dropped me off. I was this kid. at the public library on Main Street, this little library, and the librarian was waiting for me. And she said, "Bobby, I know you like comic books. I have something else I think you will like." And she took me to a shelf of Ray Bradbury stories. And that really changed my life.
And you were like middle school age, like 11 or 12?
I was 10, 9 or 10. And the stories were just so imaginative and so beautifully written and all had great twist endings. And so Ray Bradbury turned me into a reader. And then I started reading all kinds of science fiction. I discovered books. I started reading Isaac Asimov and Robert Sheckley and the Dune books and all those things.
Were your parents readers?
No. No, they weren't. My dad was a blue-collar worker. My family was very poor, and my dad was a blue-collar worker. He unloaded refrigerators in a warehouse, and he never read anything. And my mother she never really understood it, you know, what I was doing. When I started writing, I'd be staying in my room typing, writing stories, writing little joke books and things. And my mother would say, "What's wrong with you? Why are you doing that? Go outside and play. What's wrong with you?" They didn't get it. Worst advice I ever got, right? Stop typing and go play.
Did other people in your life get it? Like, were you handing out joke books to classmates at school or your teachers?
Here, I have another wrong answer. No teacher ever really encouraged me. See, I was a very shy kid, and I'd do these little magazines, the joke magazines. I'd bring them in and pass them around, and, you know, for attention. And my teachers would say, "Bob, please, please stop bringing these in. Please stop." And I often think that if they hadn't asked me to stop, I might have stopped. Right?
Yeah, I understand that entirely. I was only ever a disappointment to my teachers.
Yeah. Every report card I ever got said, "Bob isn't working to the best of his abilities." Every single report card.
Once my AP English teacher wrote on a paper that I submitted, "Jesse, I fear you will never take anything in life seriously."
Well, what a wonderful thing to say. What a compliment, right?
It was very motivating.
I would love to get that.
God bless my mom. She came in and yelled at him.
Oh, yeah? Oh, that's good. That's good.
Thanks, Mom. Thanks for that one, Mom. But you went to college.
You
must have had something going.
I had the first one in my family. I lived in Columbus, and we couldn't really afford much. But when I tell college students this, when I went to Ohio State, the tuition was $125 a quarter. It was $375 a year. I always say worth every penny. But my family was so poor, we actually had to borrow money so I could go and do that. And I had the worst college experience you can have. I lived at home.
Did your siblings go to college?
Yeah, my brother did. My brother
did. You have to convince your folks to do the money borrowing?
I don't remember what happened with Bill. I don't remember how he did it. But it was, you know, it was tough. But I went to college because they had a humor magazine. When back in the 60s, every college had a humor magazine. And I wanted to work on the humor magazine. And at Ohio State, there was a magazine called The Sundial, which had been around from 1917 or something. James Thurber was editor of it. And I was editor of the magazine for 3 years, 3 years in a row. That's all I did in college. I just did this humor magazine.
Did you know that was there when you were applying to school?
Yes.
Had you like picked it up at coffee shops near campus or something?
Yeah, I'd seen it, you know, in high school, I'd seen it. And I got to do this magazine. And in those days, the editor of the magazine got 23% of the profits, and it paid my way to New York City. So I was desperate to get out of Columbus.
I'm just impressed it was profitable.
What? No, come on, Jesse, it was good. It was good. We sold a lot.
Was it currency on campus? Like, could you get anywhere by saying, hey, I'm the editor of that?
Not at all. No, the opposite, I would think.
Was it your plan to do that with your life already?
Yes. I knew when I was 9, I loved doing it. I started out, I wanted to be I love comic books. I wanted to be an illustrator. I wanted to be a comic book illustrator. And so I started doing little comics, 4th grade, 5th grade. And I'd bring them in, and the kids would say, well, Bob, your drawings suck. You're terrible. And I would look around at what everyone else could do, and I couldn't draw anything. So I realized I had to write. And then I started writing all this stuff, and I just loved it. I think partly because I was this fearful kid, and I could stay in my room and type and create my own people and worlds. I think that's one reason I liked it so much.
I mean, there's being fearful of, you know, going out, social situations, the kinds of things that keep kids in their room. But it is a pretty audacious plan to think, yeah, I'm going to go to college to do this impractical thing. Then I am going to move to New York to do that same impractical thing.
Right. I wanted my own humor. I loved Mad Magazine, as with many people, a very big influence on me. And that's what I wanted to do.
What was your relationship to the counterculture at the time when you were in school and just after as it kind of exploded?
I was not part of it at all. You know, I'm this college kid living at home. I thought it was all fascinating, very intriguing. But I was not, you know, I was a shy, repressed kid. Guy, I was never really part of any of that.
Did you date in college?
Yeah, it's near the end of college. But I was a very shy guy. No, you know, no one ever asked me that question before. That's interesting.
Were you shy at the magazine, or was it like your world?
No, I was the editor. I was the boss. So, you know, we do what I wanted to do with it.
What was your plan when you moved to New York?
My plan was to, first I had to support myself. I moved to New York. I didn't know a single person in the city. And so I had to start getting jobs and to support myself. But my plan was to find a way to work on a humor magazine and to write funny novels for adults. I wanted to write humorous novels for adults. People have forgotten Max Schulman, who is a very big humorist in the Midwest. He wrote the Adobe Gillis books, I don't know, and people don't remember any of this stuff. But he was a real hero of mine, and so were other really funny writers, and I wanted to be one. But I ended up, I had to get work. My very first job in New York was making up interviews with the stars. I went to work for this woman who had a brownstone on 95th Street. She worked out of her brownstone. This was before working at home was, you know, the thing. And she had 6 movie magazines that she had to fill every month, 6 monthly movie magazines. And there were 3 of us on the staff. And we sat all day and made up interviews with movie stars. I would come in the morning and she would say, write an interview with Jane Fonda. Write an interview with Diana Ross. Do an interview with the Beatles. And I would sit down and write an interview. That was my first job in New York. It's a great job.
Did you have to phone them in to Diana Ross's publicist, or
no,
was it soup to
no
nuts?
No one knew. No. This was way before People magazine. No, we just made up everything. Or we'd have a little news clipping and make up the story. I remember one day I wrote 2 articles. One was, those rumors about Tom Jones, they're not true. And then that afternoon I wrote, the rumors about Tom Jones, they're true. You know, for a different magazine. It was very creative work. And I learned how to write really fast because I had to do 2 or 3 interviews a day. It was good training.
Did the three of you like pass them between each other to spell check or whatever?
There was no time for that. No time for that.
Who are the other people that worked with you?
I don't remember at all. Come on, this was 50 years ago, you know? It's a long time ago. But I thought it was a good job.
For some reason, I'm imagining the woman you worked for like carrying a Pomeranian and wearing a fur shrug.
No, well, you're like pretty close.
A threadbare dress.
You're pretty close. She wore a brown bathrobe. She never got dressed. She never got dressed. And the thing is, she never went to the movies. She had six magazines.
How did you even get the gig? Was it like an ad in the newspaper?
Yes. In those days, there were classified ads in the Times, you know, before, you know, they lost them all. And on Sunday, there would be two or three pages of jobs, publishing jobs, listed in the Times. And you would go through the Times and circle jobs you were interested in, publishing jobs, and then go call them on Monday. That's all gone, of course.
One of my favorite movies is 1,000 Clowns, and there's a scene where
yes.
the protagonist and his semi-son are going through the classified job listings. And I think often of Murray Burns having an ex-opti as an exec assist.
That's great.
But I mean, let's be frank, your career wasn't that far off. I mean, you're a few years later than that mm-hmm. film, 5 years-ish.
Yeah, it was like 68, 69.
Yeah. So you're trying to be, to the extent a comic novelist can be credible, you're trying to be a credible comic novelist. And you're writing, you have literally the strangest, goofiest writing job on earth. How long did you do it?
Not very long. Not very long. And then I had a horrible job for a year. But I had to support myself. I was assistant editor of Soft Drink Magazine. And I see you're laughing. It's not funny. It wasn't funny. I wrote about new syrups, and flip-top cans were coming in. And I had to cover bottlers conventions. And yeah, and I did that for a year.
Did you go to the bottlers convention?
I had to.
What was it like?
To photograph them. And listen, there were three different soft drink magazines. It was very competitive.
What were the competitors?
Beverage Digest. I forget the third one. It was dog eat dog business. I was shared an office. We shared an office with Candy Industry Journal. And they got much better samples than we did.
Did having these weird jobs change your career goals or your ideas about what you could do?
No, not really. I kept, I'd write at night and everything. The thing is, nobody wants humorous novels for adults. Nobody ever wanted them, you know? It's not a good career choice. But I got lucky. But I would everything that's ever happened to me really happened by accident. It wasn't my thinking it out where I ended up, really. Because I answered an ad at Scholastic, and I ended up writing for kids. I went to work at Scholastic. I was assistant editor of Junior Scholastic magazine, writing history and geography articles. And it was a magazine, it was better than soft drinks. So I went to work there, but I never thought of writing for kids. It wasn't my dream.
What did they tell you when you got there? Like what was the mandate?
Well, it was a weekly news magazine for kids. And they had, Scholastic had a whole bunch of them at the time.
Were you bad at it to begin with?
No, writing's the only thing I'm good at. You can ask my wife. That's the only thing I'm competent at. No, I was always, I'm a good writer. I had been a teacher for a year back in Ohio, trying to avoid the draft. And so I knew a little bit about education. And I mean, I wasn't great at it. I never liked to do research. I'm in my books now, I never do research. I make everything up. So in one article, I got the capital of Brazil wrong. And James Michener wrote in to say that I'd gotten the capital of Brazil wrong. Why was he reading Junior Scholastic magazine?
He did not.
Yes, James Michener said, "I'm sorry to tell you, Rio de Janeiro is no longer the capital of whatever."
Sincerely, James Michener, author of Shogun?
Yes. Yeah, what did he write? Hawaii, he wrote. He wrote a lot of things.
Did you learn something about what was different about writing for kids relative to, say, writing for syrup distributors?
Yeah, here's what I learned. There was a thing called the Dale Chall method. Is this interesting to anybody? I don't know.
It's interesting to me.
Yeah? Oh, good. It teaches you how to write to a grade level. So it gives you, like, vocabulary tips and what you can do, like writing at a fourth grade reading level or writing at a fifth grade reading level. And this turned out to be really valuable as far as Goosebumps goes. So I learned all this. And then at Scholastic, I was given a magazine, a social studies magazine. It was for kids, junior high kids, seventh and eighth graders, who read at a fourth grade level. And so I could then practice and figure out and make sure that these kids could read it. It was a fourth grade level. And this really helped me because Goosebumps is the same. It's at a fourth or fifth grade level. It never goes above that.
What were the things that you had to modulate to hit the grade level?
Sentence length, for one thing, and just length of words and, you know, simple vocabulary words. There's nothing challenging in Goosebumps. You never learn any new words in it.
Yeah, and you have to focus on what you are actually trying to write or say, because you can't dance around it.
Yeah. Well, what's hard for me is, you know, writing for 10-year-olds, is that harder than the language part is that they have no references. They don't know anything. They were born in 2012, if they're 10, right? So they don't remember anything. They don't know anything. They have no references. That, to me, is the hardest part.
You're like crossing out your BJ and the Bear jokes.
Those always get taken out.
Your first kind of career success was writing humor for kids. That was kind of the track that you ended up on. Did you think that you had, by the time that you were doing that and, you know, making a middle-class living doing that, did you think, I have found my career, or did you think, I am on my way somewhere else?
No. I did a humor magazine for Scholastic called Bananas for 10 years, I think from like 75 to 85. And that was my life's dream. I had my own humor magazine. It was all in color. I had a whole staff of artists and writers, and I did it for 10 years. And that's what I wanted to do. And when the magazine folded and it was over and I was out of Scholastic, I figured I would coast the rest of my life.
What kind of coast? You just head out to dinner. That's the Bananas guy. Dinner's on us.
No, I had done my life's dream. I didn't have any other real goals. That was it. I had no idea what was in store for me. And of course, that was another accident. I was never thought of writing scary stuff.
Who asked you to write your first scary book?
A woman named Jean Fywell, who was the publisher at Scholastic and a friend of mine. And we were having lunch. She showed up late for lunch. She was angry. She just had a fight with a guy who wrote teen horror. And she said, "I'm never working with him again. You could write a good teen horror book. Go home and write a book called Blind Date." She even gave me the title. I didn't know what she was talking about. What's a teen horror book? But I was at that point then where I didn't say no. You know, I was all totally freelance. I didn't say no to anything. I said, sure, no problem. And I went running to the bookstore to see what people were doing with teen horror. And I read Christopher Pike books and a whole bunch of other, Diane Ho, Richie Tankersley Cusick, Lois Duncan. They were all writing teen horror. And so I read those books to try to find out what it was, because I didn't know. And then I tried to figure out what I could do that would be different. And I wrote Blind Date, and it came out like a year later. It was a number one bestseller. It was number one on Publishers Weekly list. I thought, wait a minute, what's going on here? I'd never been close to that list with the funny stuff. And then a year later, she asked me to write another one called, it was called Twisted, number one bestseller. And I thought, forget the funny stuff. Kids like to be scared. And that's how it happened. It's kind of embarrassing because it wasn't my idea.
It's a pretty fine line between being scared and laughing.
Well, I've talked about this, but horror makes me laugh. I don't get scared. I maybe there's something missing in my brain. But I think horror is funny. I mean, going back to those comic books, they were hilarious, the horror comics. And if you go to like a horror movie and a shark, the shark jumps up and it's chewing the teenager to bits, I'm the one in the theater who's laughing. People say to me, after I read one of your books, I had to leave all the lights on. I had to lock the doors. I was so scared. I've never had that feeling. I don't know what that feeling would be. I read Stephen King. I read, you know, I can admire them. But I don't know that feeling of being scared. It always makes me laugh.
Even if you watch like The Shining or The Exorcist or something like that?
No, pretty much.
Something really genuinely upsettingly
not
terrifying.
Very often.
Like, it's one thing to laugh at a shark eating a teenager, but.
Yeah, not very often. Not very often.
Bradbury can be a little unsettling.
Yes. I recommend to kids Something Wicked This Way Comes, that novel about the evil carnival setting up in this Midwest neighborhood. That's a very scary book. And beautifully written.
I feel like every, you know, sixth grade English teacher passes out like The Veldt, and then kids read it. And I know, I mean, like, I liked it, but yeah. I found it deeply distressing.
Yes. Or that one, or the one about the rainy day. You know, that one where it just rains all the time and there's going to be one sunny day. And everyone's looking forward to it with the rain stopping, and this kid somehow he's trapped inside and he misses it. That's the other story that's really disturbing.
I mean, the things that kids are scared of are not necessarily angry giant hamsters, as in one of your books, or, you know, evil ventriloquist dummies, as in 70,000 of your books.
Yeah, yeah.
It not necessarily like those particular subjects. I feel like it is being alone, being trapped.
Being lost.
Yeah.
Being somewhere weird in the dark. Being somewhere unfamiliar. Being by yourself when you don't want to be. See, in Goosebumps, I don't really want to scare the kids. You don't really want to terrify kids. You know, you just want to get them reading. So I don't do, you know, I don't really get too deep into the real fears. It's a lot safer to do a dummy coming to life.
or a giant evil hamster, or a bunch of giant evil hamsters, I believe.
Listen, I came up with that book title. I came up with this book title. I'm walking along, Little Shop of Hamsters, which is a great title, right? So I had to do a book about it, but how do you make hamsters scary? That was a challenge. I had to do it because of the title.
There's like a guy that works for Star Wars for Lucasfilm or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think that his job is just making sure that all the pieces fit together right. You know, they do this at like the Marvel movies too, but I think there's a lot of Star Wars stuff. So there's somebody who's just in charge of making sure that nobody writes anything or says anything that contradicts what anyone else says. And I was thinking, like, at the point where you've written, which you have literally hundreds of scary books for kids, how on earth do you keep track of what premises you've already used?
Oh, I have good editors. My editors have a memory. No, seriously. You know, they say, Bob, you did that. You've already done that title. Bob, you did that in number 18. You did that. Seriously. Because it's, you know, it's impossible. I've written every story a human can write, right? So it's hard. It's a real challenge to not repeat yourself.
I mean, it's like season 14 of a sitcom or something, you know? Like, how do they make more It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia? Is it awesome?
Right.
That they can still come up with.
No, it's the same. This is my problem with Slappy the Dummy. I shouldn't say this, but, you know, I'm sick of him. I didn't say that, but because I've written 15 books about a dummy that comes to life. How many stories are there? I actually killed him in one book, The Ghost of Slappy, but then I had to bring him back. He's too popular.
Do you have a corkboard or a notebook or something that has potential book titles written on it?
No. I mean, I'm always thinking of titles, and I have a piece of paper, and I'll keep a list of titles. To be serious, I don't think of ideas anymore. I only think of titles. If I can get a good title, it'll lead me to the story. So I don't try to think of ideas.
What's an example of that? I mean, we can, Little Shop of Hamsters, we already talked about, but what's another where the title led you to the story?
Say Cheese and Die.
That's a classic.
Yeah, well, the words flashed in my mind, and I had it. So what could it be about? And then I had to start thinking, you know, what if there is a camera? What if some boys discover a camera, and the camera takes pictures of things, bad things that happen in the future? And that they start taking pictures, and that's how that story evolved. But it came from the title. I'm working on a Goosebumps book for next year called Scariest Book Ever. That's going to lead me to some kind of story, I hope. But that's backwards for most authors, right? Most authors get an idea of what they want to write, and later on they think of a title. But I have to start with a title.
Even more still to come with R.L. Stine. Stay with us. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. This message comes from Apple Card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase. That's 3% on products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card, issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval, terms apply.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, MassMutual. According to Calendar.com, the average person schedules just 4.5 hours per year on finances. MassMutual gets it. Life is busy. If you can't find time to plan your financial future, find someone who can, like a MassMutual financial professional. For the last 170 years, they've helped people plan for retirement, college tuition, and any other short or long-term financial goals. Learn more at massmutual.com.
Okay, close your eyes for a second. Now imagine you're on your dream vacation. No work calls to answer, no text messages to respond to, just your suitcase and an opportunity.
The opportunity to just take yourself out of your routine and travel deeper.
How to actually take that dream trip. That's on the Life Kit podcast from NPR.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. This week, it's our annual Bullseye Halloween Spectacular. My guest is R.L. Stine. He's the creator of the Goosebumps books, one of the best-selling book series in publishing history. Let's get back into our conversation. Why do you still write your books?
Why do I still do it?
Well, there's two questions herein. Number one is, yes, obviously, you made a lifetime's worth of money when at the peak of Goosebumps, I'm sure. You know, I'm sure you have a beautiful apartment and you don't have to worry about whether you can afford to go out to dinner if you feel like it.
I'm comfortable, yes.
Yeah. So that's one piece of it. One is, why keep working? The other part is, why keep working on this, right? Like, why not just have 1,000 other people be R.L. Stein and you just check the box next to approved?
No, that's no fun. I think it's my total lack of imagination, because I don't know what else I would do during the day. What would I do? This is what I've done, right? You know, 30 years of Goosebumps. But I still enjoy it. It's the thing. I don't dread having to sit down and start another book. I don't dread it at all. I have to tell you, I mean, I have a lot of bad things happening in my life, personal things. And we had COVID for 2 years. And 3 or 4 hours a day that I spend writing, or maybe I'm being too serious here, but those are the best hours of my day.
That said, you could be writing humorous novels for adults.
Well, I've gotten to write humorous novels for kids. I just did 3 stories about the Garbage Pail Kids. That was fun for me. I didn't have to be scary. And, you know, I've done a couple funny series for kids.
My daughter downstairs is 10 years old, and she said,
"Oh, nice.
He wrote these Garbage Pail Kids books, and they're even grosser than the cards."
That's a very nice compliment, too. Very nice. My grandson is 8, Dylan, and he's carrying on a family tradition of not reading my stuff. My son's claim to fame was that he never read one of my books. Isn't that horrible? He was the right age. That was just his way of getting dad, you know, making
me like
nuts.
Nancy Drew or nothing for me. Yeah. Sorry, Dad.
Yeah, it was Garfield comics. That's all he read. Just Garfield. Anyway, my grandson, he's 8 years old, and I have this new short story book called Stein Tinglers, because I need another series, right?
Right. Oh, that's because you thought of Stein Tinglers and you couldn't leave it alone.
I know. That's why they bought the book, of course, for the name. And I dedicated it to him. And I said, "Dylan, sit down." We were out at the house, and sit down on the couch. I'm going to read you one of these stories. I'm going to force him to listen to one of the stories, because I knew he wouldn't read it. He's busy playing Minecraft all day. And so I sat down and I read the story about bugs. It was one of the better stories in Stein Tinglers. And read, and he sat there very intent, sat there, read it. I said, "Well," I finished. "Well, what do you think?" "It's very confusing." That's it. That was the whole reaction. "It's very confusing."
Why did you want to write even shorter?
Because I'm stupid. I'm stupid. Why? Who would want to write 10 short stories? It was a crazy idea. It's like writing 10 novels. You need 10 beginnings, 10 middles, 10 good endings. And I'm doing 3 of these books. I just finished the one for next summer.
Are you proud of your work? And 2 sub-questions on this. One line is, are you proud of your work in its constituent parts? And one is, are you proud of your work in the aggregate?
I'm proud of the millions of kids who got into reading from my books. That's what I never get tired of hearing parents who come up to me and say, "My kid never read a book in his life, and I caught him under the covers with a flashlight reading a Goosebumps book last night." I never get tired of hearing that. And I just, it's so gratifying. All these, just millions of kids who turned to books for entertainment and who got it from reading my books.
As a guy who was writing 12 books a year at the peak of your Goosebumps productivity, you can't possibly have been too actively involved in all of the peripheral Goosebumpsery.
No.
A lot of it is pretty good. I was watching the old Goosebumps TV show when my daughter was at the peak of her Goosebumps obsession. I was like, this is not bad at all.
No, I was pretty lucky. I've been very lucky with, like, the two Goosebumps movies. They didn't have to be good, and I had no input in them at all. And they were both really good. And the TV series.
They're legitimately good. They're really fun movies.
Yeah. And the Goosebumps series back in the 90s, we had these two guys who just got it. I had no time to, you know, I'm writing a book a month. I had no time to work on the TV series. And they just got it, and they did it so well. That's all luck, of course. Could have been awful.
Did you really write the, like, storybook version of Big Top Pee Wee?
Yes. I did, I did novelizations for quite a while before Fear Street caught on. I did most of them for Scholastic, I think.
Did somebody just, like, hand them out at a meeting once a week?
Well, they would sign up. They would get rights to a movie, and then they'd ask an author to write a novelization real quick. I did the novelization of Spaceballs, the Mel Brooks movie. That was fun. That was really fun. I added a lot of jokes, though, and then I thought, oh, my God, he'll be furious about it. But I never heard from him, of course. But with Big Top Pee Wee, so I recall, Pee-wee hated what I did, and he asked that the book go out with just photographs and not my text.
Oh, he's very careful about Pee-wee. I made a radio show with him, and never have I met someone who is so, I mean, look, Pee-wee's one of the greatest things ever, so I would be careful about it too.
So talented.
But he's extraordinarily careful with it.
Uh-huh. I don't remember what his problem was with the work I did, but I think he hated it.
It seems like at some point you came to enjoy the craft part of this. Like, somewhere between writing fake movie star interviews and accidentally becoming a squajillionaire on the, you know, completely being blindsided by that, I'm sure.
Totally.
There must have been some point where you were like, you know what I like? I like sitting down and solving the problem of how do I make this into something that kids will get a kick out of?
That's true. It's puzzle solving.
Do you remember when you started feeling that way?
No. It just developed. It developed with the success. I wrote for 20 years before anyone noticed, really.
When no one was noticing, did you not feel that way?
I just kept on. I, you know, had to make a living, and I loved writing, and I wrote all kinds of things. I wrote Bazooka Joe comics.
For real?
Yeah, I wrote jokes. I got $25 a joke.
Did you write the gags for the panels or the jokes that ran down at the bottom?
Down in the bubble gum.
Yeah, well, there was like a three panel comic, right?
Yeah,
and then there was like something printed underneath the three panel comic, as
no,
I remember.
I wrote the three panels. $25
oh
a joke.
Do you remember any of the jokes you wrote
for
Bazooka Joe Mort and the gang?
No.
I can't think of any other characters besides Bazooka Joe and Mort. Mort was the one with the turtleneck that covered his face.
Yeah, well, what was his name? Maybe he didn't have a name. But when Fear Street started really doing well, and when Goosebumps had this amazing success, I mean, it just, I really got very serious about what I was doing. And I was, of course, enjoying it so much more. It was such a surprise.
Do you think that in part you were, look, this is a psychoanalysis question for which I apologize in advance.
Oh, boy.
But you were the one who brought up being serious earlier. Do you think that the fact that you started writing in a situation where your folks maybe kind of thought it was a waste. You weren't getting a lot of positive feedback for it from teachers, and it was obviously much more impractical than becoming an electrician or whatever. Do you think that feeling of needing to do it in a way that made it a job ever left you?
I don't know. I the feeling of surprise never left. That's too deep for me, I think. I've never, seriously, I don't know if I can answer that question. It's just what I've always done. People always say, what else would you do if you didn't? But that's what, it's the only thing I've ever done. I mean, I was an editor for a while, but I don't know.
Well, R.L. Stine, I sure appreciate you coming on the show. You're every bit as jovial as your former pen name, Jovial Bob.
Thank you, Jesse. Hey, this has really been fun.
R.L. Stine. His newest book is called Stine Tinglers. It's a collection of 10 short horror stories for kids. Go get it from your local bookstore. It's the Bullseye Halloween Spectacular. I'm Jesse Thorne. It's time now for the craziest day of my entire career. On deck, Monet Exchange. Monet is a drag queen, an icon in that world, a legend on RuPaul's Drag Race. On that show, she showcased her many talents, including a breathtaking opera performance. Vera viso. Monet Exchange is also the co-host of the 2022 Huluween Drag Stravaganza on Hulu.
We've been dragged to a world full of fright, of things that creep and crawl and go bump in the night. It's glam and it's gore, it's bloody couture, and every freaky thing we've ever seen before.
Here's the premise. Monet and her co-host Ginger Minj get stuck in an old haunted television, and the only way out is to host a hilarious, larger-than-life variety special. Sketches, musical numbers, cameos, the whole nine yards. When we asked Monet Exchange about the craziest day of her entire career, she had a story locked and loaded. We'll let her take it from here.
My name is Monet Exchange, and this is the craziest day of my entire career. Okay, so the craziest day of my career, I had, you know, I just competed on RuPaul's Drag Race season 10, where I was voted Miss Congeniality. And I was really feeling my superstar celebrity drag fantasy. And I was ready to take America by storm. So I was doing a club tour at different clubs all over the country, you know, in Seattle, in San Diego, all these places. And I found myself, I ended up in El Paso, Texas, for a night that I'll never forget. I was doing this thing back then of propositioning the audience to buy me tequila. And if you bought me tequila, I would drink it. And I just got drunker and drunker as the night went on. And, you know, I've been drinking since I was in high school, you know, and I have never, ever been blackout drunk. It was my first time ever being blackout drunk. And since then, it has not happened again. For folks who have never seen me live, this was... was 2018. This was Monet 4 years ago. A lot has changed and grown in 4 years. I don't necessarily do the club circuit anymore, but back then, what you would see, I would come out, I would tell a few jokes, I would do a number, go do a costume change, and then I would come back out, tell some more jokes, and do another drag number, and then that would be it. So that's what my little club shows looked like back in the day. But now, I'm very happy to be doing just full club comedy club tours. I do my comedy set for an hour, or right now, currently, I'm on Sibling Rivalry Live, the tour of my podcast about the drag queen. So things have changed, but back then, that's what she was doing, girl. Telling jokes, drinking tequila, and, you know, you fill in the rest. So my assistant Patty is watching the chaos as it happens, and he's like, oh my God, who is this person? I've never seen you like this, Monet. And he's like, you know what? But we need to get to the hotel. We had a very early flight because we had next stop on my little club tour. It was in Columbus, Ohio. Our flight was at 4:50 a.m., which means you have to be at the airport by 3:50 a.m., which means, and we were in El Paso, so the airport was like 45 minutes away, which means we had to leave our hotel at 2:50 a.m. And we were still at the club at 1 o'clock in the morning. And he's like trying to wrangle, get me together so he can get in an Uber and back to the hotel. But I was just too busy feeling myself, girl. But, you know, Patty is a strong 5'3" little ginger, and he gathered my big behind and got me in the Uber, and we made our way to the hotel. So we're in the Uber, we get to the hotel. It's then it hits me that I need to use the potty. Number one was a knock-in, and I was like, oh my God, like, what did I do? And I remember looking at the front desk, looking at Patty, and just letting go and letting God. Immediately, in that moment, I started to apologize profusely. I was like, I am so sorry. I'm so sorry. Please. I apologized profusely to the staff. I said, hey, I will clean this up for you. Please just give me a mop and a bucket. I'll take care of this. They begged me to leave them alone and go upstairs. And I got in the elevator and went up to my room. I have like tidbits of me being in my room. I remember being in the room and saying to myself, okay, you have to pack. But there were so many other thoughts swirling through my brain. And I was like, you need to pack, but you also need to sleep. So I chose sleep. And to Patty's dismay, when he was time for him to come back to help to get the Uber to help me in my bags and go downstairs, I was unresponsive. So little Patty had to go down to the front desk and ask them to call my room to the phone would ring because my cell phone was dead. As they called me, I jumped up out of sleep, answered the phone. And I was like, yeah. And then he came upstairs and he saw my things were still not packed. And I said, just give me 5 minutes. Just 5 minutes, I will pack it, which I did. I just got all my things together, put them in my suitcase, and I was downstairs ready to go in fact, 5 minutes, maybe seven. So we're on this flight, and we were on the flight from El Paso to Atlanta. Everything was fine. I slept. I was feeling good. We got off. When we were getting off the plane, the flight attendant goes, he's like, oh my God, Monet Exchange, I love you so much. You were so good on season 10. I was rooting for you. I was like, oh my God, I was rooting for me too. That's crazy. And he then said, can I have a picture? And I said, of course. So we take the picture together. And, you know, civilians who don't do drag are just generally bad at taking pictures. There's normally any flash, there's shadows everywhere, it's just not good. So I always say, let me see the picture to make sure it's okay. And I took his phone to look at the picture, and I was shocked because I was still in full drag. I had never taken my makeup off from the night before. I just had a face full of makeup and, like, some joggers and, like, a hoodie from Aeropostale or something with a full face of makeup on. So then we get to Columbus, we check into the hotel, and I open my backpack, and I'm like, wait, where is my computer? I definitely had it, and I immediately thought, oh God, you in your state, you left it somewhere in your hotel room in El Paso. So I text Patty, I'm like, please call the hotel, they need to, like, find a way to overnight my computer to me, yada, yada, yada. And I open my suitcase, so I start getting my makeup off. I have to put my makeup off to get ready for the next show. And as soon as I open my suitcase, I just see my laptop is flat, face open, in my luggage, not closed like a normal person would. I just, in my state, just dumped it open face into my computer. I mean, into my luggage. But you know, it's Mac, honey. Steve Jobs got me together because it was fine. My computer was absolutely fine. I think this is one of the craziest days of my career because, you know, I was young. 4 years ago, I was just younger, and I looking back, I would never do that again. And I used to work at a hotel, and that's what I did before. I was a front desk agent. I know how annoying it is to have drunk guests come into a hotel. And I wasn't even just drunk. I fully, you know, let go and let God in the lobby of this person's work. So that part I'm not very proud of, and I feel so bad. And if I ever go to El Paso again, I'm gonna ask. I think I remember his name. His name was Jeffrey. I'm gonna ask, is Jeffrey here? And I want to give Jeffrey $100,000. Something that you went on RuPaul's Drag Race to apologize in the tone, but I did. Yeah, so in hindsight, I would never behave that way again. And, you know, I think it was a very big lesson for me in knowing your limits and not being raggedy and messy in El Paso. Maybe in New York, not El Paso.
Monet Exchange on the craziest day of her entire career. Make sure to watch Monet Exchange and Ginger Minj on Hulu's 2022 Huluween Drag Stravaganza. Monet Exchange is also touring a lot these days. We'll have a link to dates on our website. Visit the Bullseye page at MaximumFun.org. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. We're doing things a little differently this week. It's our 2022 Bullseye Halloween Spectacular. My next guest is Anna Fabrega. She's a comedian, actor, and writer. She worked on The Chris Gethard Show, had parts in High Maintenance, and At Home with Amy Sedaris. But she's probably best known as a star and co-creator of one of my favorite shows on television, Los Espookies. It is a little awkward for me to be hosting a Halloween spectacular because I am not a horror guy. I am not into slasher movies. I am not into ghost movies. I am not into jump scares. None of these things appeal to me. And I want you to know that Los Espookies is not a horror show, or at least not really a horror show. It's about four weirdos who love horror, and they run a company where they go around town and bring scenes from horror movies to real life. Or I guess maybe the kinds of things you would see in horror movies. Demonic possessions, sea monsters, creepy aliens, that kind of thing. It is a sweet, goofy, and surreal program about friendship and carving a place in the world for yourself. And frankly, the spooky stuff is almost immediately incidental. Los Espookies just wrapped up its second season, which was even better than the first one, which I already really loved. I'm thrilled to have Anna Fabrega on the show. Let's get into it. Anna Fabrega, welcome to Bullseye. I'm so, so happy to have you on the show. I'm such a fan.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
You're from Scottsdale, Arizona. You grew up in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Yeah.
What did you think of Scottsdale, Arizona when you were a kid?
We moved there when I was in first grade, like in the middle of the school year. We had been in Iowa before that. And so, you know, aesthetically, very different from Iowa. In my teenage years, I felt just kind of like bored. And there's not a ton to do there. I mean, I think most places when you're a teenager, you only have so many options. But I definitely knew I wanted to leave. So when I was, you know, 17 and a senior in high school and was applying to schools, I was like, I want to go to New York. But when I started going back, once I moved to New York, I started to appreciate the desert landscape much more. I took it for granted growing up that it's really beautiful.
I read you describing somewhere feeling like you didn't realize the extent to which you didn't fit in when you were an adolescent until you were in New York and had perspective on your adolescence. Like, you didn't have an unhappy childhood. It was just, you were like, oh, wow, there's all this possibility.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, like, by no means was I, like, you know, unhappy or anything. Like, I had my friends. I was, like, you know, the type of kid in school who was, like, I wasn't, like, the popular kid, but I was friends with everyone. So it's, like, the popular kids liked me, but I wasn't hanging out with them, you know? I was, like, you know, very much had, like, my small group of close friends. And we had shared interests and, you know, would bond over similar things. And then going to New York, like, the first 4 years that I was here when I was in school, I didn't find people that I felt like I had, you know, things I could connect with or felt like we had similar, you know, sense of humor or interests or anything. So then I just kind of went, like, full, like, I don't know, like, sort of reclusive. And, like, my sister was living in New York at the time, so I would just hang out with her and her friends and then just, like, treat school as, like, put my head down, go to class, go to work, go home, do my homework. Like, I wasn't very social in college. And then when I graduated, a year after I graduated and I started doing stand-up is when I was like, oh, here's where my people are. Here are where, like, the people that I do sort of feel like I belong with are. And then found my, like, community that I didn't ever really find when I was in college, after college.
What was it that didn't feel like it was a fit with the other kids when you were in college?
Just, like, you know, when you make a joke and someone just goes, like, you're so weird. Just, like, that feeling of, like, oh, like, you don't want to, like, joke back. You just think that it's, like, absurd that somebody would say this. You know what I mean? It was that sort of feeling.
I mean, look, I'm going to play a clip from the Chris Cathard show for which you wrote. And I just don't think I can describe how particular your work is without playing a little bit of it. And, you know, the videos you make for social media maybe are a little short and visual, but there's enough words in this. And basically this is you after a writer's meeting convincing Chris and the show's head writer or director that you have some ideas that they need to hear. And initially they're going to be all ideas about scorpions. And there's a picture of a scorpion on your binder of ideas.
Yeah.
I don't think that we hear, I don't remember if there's scorpion jokes in there, but let's listen to the clip.
So the first idea, really simple. I'm walking down the street. There's a sign that says wet paint. And I walk up to it, I touch it. If it's dry, I remove the sign.
Yeah.
And if it's wet, I leave it. Okay, there's one where I'm playing baseball. I'm up to bat, and as the ball comes, I drop the bat and I punch the ball and then I run. So it's like, I mean, the backstory could be that I used to be a boxer. Or we could do it where instead, when the ball comes, instead of dropping the bat, I turn around and I hit the ball so it keeps going that way.
Can you do that?
I mean, we could try.
So, you can see how this in little moments can play on social media, especially to people who signed up for it. How did it play when you started doing stand-up open mics?
So I, like, you know, had been making videos and I didn't know what it would look like to try to sort of take what I like doing online and do it live. And so the first few times I went to open mics, I was like, well, stand-up is like a setup and a punchline and you tell a story. And so I had sort of like the line that I thought was funny, and then I would write, like, context around it so that it would be, like, a little story the way I thought stand-up had to be. And I did that a few times, and I was like, this doesn't feel right. Like, what if I tried to just say the line that's funny to me? And then I did that, and I felt like, oh, okay, this is, I think, the way that, you know, I should approach it, that, like, I don't need to try to make this look like what I think stand-up has to be. And a big part of sort of that moment of, like, oh, I can do anything was, like, starting to go to mics that were like from other people but had more similar sensibilities, and kind of seeing like, oh yeah, it's, you know, stand-up is solo comedic performance and you can interpret it however you want and do anything you want within it. And the type of like, you know, specials on Comedy Central that I saw growing up is like one way to do this, but it's not the only way. And so then, yeah, I think the first few years I was doing stand-up was kind of trying to figure out like, what does, like, how do I take the thing that I think is funny and like present that in a live format?
What was the first thing that you did on stage that really worked that you feel like still kind of represents you?
I remember the first open mic I went to where I was like, I'm going to try to just say the lines that are funny to me. I had been going to an open mic that was at UCB because I didn't know where else to go.
The Upright Citizens Brigade Theater in New York.
Yeah, there were open mics there. And so I would go there and I felt like this doesn't feel right. And then some friends who I had known in college through another friend, they went to a different school. They were like, we kind of want to do stand up too. And there's this mic in Bushwick called Do Something. And it was one that River Ramirez would host with, at the time, DJ Jeep Grand Cherokee, who would kind of do like psychotic visuals and torture people during their set sometimes. But it was like, you know, they were like, let's go to this mic. And I was like, okay, I'm going to maybe this will be the mic where I try to just say the lines. And I remember like I had a joke. I mean, I don't think it's a good joke, but it kind of embodies the like that moment of like, oh, yeah, I think this is my thing. Was just kind of like marching in place for a sec and then like, whew, like sighing and saying that like, I hate going upstairs. It was something like that. And it's like, whatever. And people like really laughed. And I was like, oh, yeah, I can just like do this and people get it. And it's maybe not like a joke, but there's something funny about someone like just doing that. And people go, you know, they relate to it. Like, yeah, it's tiring to go upstairs.
I mean, speaking of not recognizing where you belonged or not recognizing the extent to which you were out of place as a teenager and adolescent, I read that you realized you were queer, like, as an adult.
Yeah. Yeah, I was like, I mean, it's like funny now because it seems so obvious. Even from like the youngest age, like photos of me, I'm like dressed like a tomboy. I mean, I'm dressed in things that like queer people wear now. I have like a little chain. I'm like, oh, wow. I really like, you know, when I was 5, it was so obvious. But I think part of it was just kind of like the environment I grew up in was like very heteronormative and straight. And like everyone at my school was like, there were no openly gay people. There was like maybe a couple people in like the theater department that people were like, I think he's gay, but no one was like really open. It was very like, you know, I don't know, not a place I think that sort of lent itself to that sort of like exploration. And so I just thought like, well, I'm not really that attracted to guys. So like maybe I'm just asexual. It like didn't occur to me that like maybe I like non-cis males. Like, I don't know. And so then like, yeah, in college, I was similarly just like not dating, not interested, nothing, very like sort of, I think like so out of touch with that part of myself and not open to the possibility that like maybe I wasn't straight. I was actually thinking about this the other day. I was in college. I forget what year it was, but it was the year that Blue is the Warmest Color came out. And I felt like, huh, I want to see that movie. I don't know why, but I want to see it. And I go to the theater and I'm like so self-conscious going to the theater because I'm like, people are going to think I'm gay because I want to see this movie. And I was like by myself. I was like, oh, my God, like, I hope I don't see anyone at the theater. You know, I went to like the IFC Center downtown, and in the middle of the movie, there's a problem with the projector and they have to stop the movie and the lights come up. And I feel like, oh, my God, now the whole theater is going to be looking at me and thinking that I'm gay because I'm here. And like it was such it, I mean, it, when I look back on it, I'm like, oh, my God, I was like had so much like sort of like deep internalized homophobia and was like terrified at the thought of like, what if I am gay? And then seeing that movie, I was like, oh my God, I relate to this. And I was like, no. This can't be happening. This can't be me. No, it's not me. And then it still took me like a while to sort of like come to terms with it and like be okay with it. And then once I did, I was like, oh, damn. Like, if I had done this a long time ago, I would have felt so much happier, I'm sure. You know, it's not like something that I like necessarily knew and was repressing. I just like didn't know. And then once I thought maybe it was that, I still needed time to be like, you know, it's okay to like explore it and see if it is. But yeah, blue is the warmest color was huge for me.
I feel like Los Espookies is one of the queerest shows on television. And I don't know exactly. I mean, there's gay characters on it, but like, I don't know exactly what besides that makes it the one of the queer shows on television.
I think it's that like the show is not trying to be anything or like trying to fit any sort of mold. It just sort of like is itself and it is what it is. And like, I don't know. I think like, especially like writing the second season, I feel like the show is so just okay with being itself. And like, there's no agenda. There's no like sort of desire to teach the audience. It's just sort of like, no, this is just what like comes out of us. And we're, you know, Julio and I are both queer, and a lot of the actors on our on the show that are friends of ours are queer, and it's so just, you know, it just is. But I think it's just because we're just being ourselves when we write it.
When you were writing Los Espookies, like the thought of you handing it in to the executive who's also in charge of, you know, the Sex and the City reboot and Hacks and like none of those things being bad. Like, I especially like Hacks, but, you know, just like to somebody who's in charge of regular television shows.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I think that Julio and I didn't realize when we were making the first season how sort of unusual it was to be able to make this type of show. Like, and, you know, we weren't involved in pitching or selling the show. Like, Fred had sold the pilot to HBO about like a group of horror makeup enthusiasts in Mexico City. That was like the original idea. And then once they ordered a script, he brought us on board to develop it. And then it became, you know, Los Espookies. And so I think that like had Julio and I gone in and tried to pitch what the show ultimately became, I'm sure we would have gotten a lot of like, what is this? Why? No. And so it feels almost like we were able to like Trojan horse the show like into the like, you know, people's TVs just via like how we went about getting involved. But like, yeah, I do feel really like fortunate. And I mean, and especially like once I started to like pitch my own projects and I saw the way that people sort of react to or have a hard time, I think, feeling comfortable with ideas that maybe aren't as like linear as they're used to or as sort of, you know, conventional story structure that they're used to. Like, then I was like, oh man, it feels like a miracle that we got this show made. And I think it really, you know, HBO has been so supportive in letting us, you know, make it the way that we want to make it. And I feel very fortunate for that.
I mean, right from the start, Los Espookies is a show about a group of like a crew, like a group of friends who work together as real life special effects artists, sort
of. Yeah, it's like they like deceive people. They yeah. help people trick other people.
And like when they're doing a haunted house for an inheritance. Like, you have to spend the night in this haunted house thing. All of the effects that they do involve like pulleys, like visible pulleys, and like Day-Glo paint.
It's very like scrappy and DIY. Like, you know, we wanted it to feel very like practical. Like, they're not doing like David Blaine style optical illusions. Like, no, you can see the rope and pulleys if you just look closely. But people buy it.
But this is also a program where, like, I was just watching the first episode of season two, and it features heavily what appears to be the ghost of a beauty contestant who's been impaled on an anchor.
Yes.
And she doesn't come from Pulley's world.
No. So it's like a mix of like the things that they do, we want them to feel practical. But then in their world, it's just sort of like anything can kind of happen. And it is kind of like surreal and abstract and absurd. But that the effects that they do are kind of like lame. Like even in the first episode of season two, when they do the ghosts, it's like it looks like lame. It doesn't look cool and good. It looks just kind of like, oh, we see the ropes when you guys are going up, you know, but people buy it, which I think is really funny.
We'll wrap up with Anna Fabrega after a quick break. Stick around. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com. This message comes from Jackson. Let's face it, retirement planning can be confusing. At Jackson, we're working to make retirement clear for everyone, starting with you. Our easy-to-understand resources and user-friendly digital tools help simplify your entire experience. You can have confidence in your retirement with clarity from Jackson. Seek the clarity you deserve at Jackson.com. Jackson is short for Jackson Financial Incorporated, Jackson National Life Insurance Company, Lansing, Michigan, and Jackson National Life Insurance Company of New York, Purchase, New York.
Support for NPR and the following message come from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
Hi, I'm Jesse Thorne, the founder of Maximum Fun, and I have a special announcement. I'm no longer embarrassed by my brother and me. You know, for years, each new episode of this supposed advice show was a fresh insult, a depraved jumble of erection jokes, ghost humor, and frankly, this is for the best, very little actionable advice. But now, as they enter their twilight years, I'm as surprised as anyone to admit that it's gotten kind of good. Justin, Travis, and Griffin's witticisms are more refined, like a humor column in a fancy magazine, and they hardly ever say bazinga anymore. So, after you've completely finished listening to every single one of all of our other shows, why not join the McElroy Brothers every week for my brother, and me? It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking with Anna Fabrega. She's the star and co-creator of HBO's Los Espookies. One of the things that's special about Los Espookies to me is the Tati in particular, but several of the main characters of the show have such a warm positivity, and that isn't always a quality on a comedy thing that's this odd or distinctive. It is something that you see a lot in Fred Armisen's work, who originally created the show, and it's something that I feel from, you know, your online work that I've seen. But was that a choice to make a show about, that's theoretically about dark goths, so wide-eyed and smiling?
I mean, I don't know if it was necessarily a conscious choice. I think that Julio and I are, like, optimistic people. And, like, so the characters that we, you know, created for the show wound up being like that. And also it's like, you know, goth people are not just, like, frowning all the time. Like, they laugh with their friends and they're, you know, have a full range of emotions. So we're like, okay, let's have their like ringleader Renato be like really sweet and have like a little dog that he takes care of and like, you know, just things like that. But yeah, I do think that overall it's a very like happy and like upbeat show, you know, in a way that I think is, yeah, nice.
So the show was originally, as you said, going to be set in Mexico City. And one of the stars of the show, Bernardo Velasco, who plays Reynaldo, who's the like the mastermind of this operation, such as it is. Or at least he's the guy who keeps barreling forward, at the very least. He's Mexican. How did you... And he feels very Mexican, like as a guy in LA from a Mexican American neighborhood in San Francisco, like he feels very Mexican. And he also, like as a straight guy,
I just want to be his friend so desperately. Like, just, he's just everyone's dream of what your dude friend would be, attitude wise. So how did you cast him?
So, like, when we were making the pilot and casting the pilot, at this time the show was still going to be set in Mexico. So we were like, okay, Julio and I are not Mexican. Fred's not Mexican. We need our other, like, lead actors to be Mexican. And the director who did the first episode knew Bernardo, because Bernardo also works as a casting director. And he works a lot with, like, found actors. He's very good at, like, yeah, if finding people that are not actors and training them for film and TV and stuff. And he's, like, a talented stage actor too. And so our director for the pilot was like, you know, he should audition. And as soon as we saw his tape, we were like, oh my God, yes, it's him. Of course it's him. And the same with Cassandra, who plays Ursula. She's also Mexican. And similarly, like, yeah, once we saw her, we're like, oh yeah, it's gotta be her. And then once the show was no longer set in Mexico, you know, and there was no sort of parameters on where they live or anything, then it was like, yeah, you guys can keep your accents. You can, you know, infuse your dialogue with, like, Mexican slang if you want. I mean, especially Bernardo's character uses a lot of slang. But yeah, it was like, I'm so happy that we sort of wound up picking from that pool in Mexico, because otherwise we wouldn't have found the two of them.
Velasco has a level of friendship charisma that is so extraordinary that it leads you to believe that all of these characters would be friends with each other. And that feels to me like the special trick of Los Espookies is, well, Julio Torres as a performer is so sui generis that you can hardly imagine him talking to anyone else, you know what I mean? Uh-huh. Much less having a relationship with them, because he's just so his own thing. And your character is such a doofus, and you know what I mean? Like, there's so much going on there that you like need somebody that you could believe could bind any group of human beings together.
Yeah, and I mean, and that's Bernardo in real life. He is so sweet and so kind and charming, and just like, everyone that meets him is like, oh, in love, because he's really like the best. And same with Cassandra. Like, when we got to know each other shooting the first season, I thought, like, man, we really lucked out, like, that we have these people that we're going to be working with a lot and that we really like and get along with, who bring so much to the characters. And, like, I mean, especially after we shot the first season, I feel like Bernardo and Cassandra's characters became so much more clear to us and helped us write better stories for them in season two. And yeah, they're like as sort of, I mean, Bernardo is as like captivating and friendly and like lovable as his character.
What's something that you learned about his character from seeing him perform it?
Like, he can be so like earnest and sweet in a way that I think I hadn't anticipated with the character. Like, we knew like, oh, it's kind of funny if he's like a little bit of like a mama's boy or something, like didn't fully like grow up, still at home. But then the way that he played it was like that, but not sort of making fun of it. It was like very sweet and like, yeah, I think just like he's so like, well, he has good intentions and is like always putting other people before himself. And yeah, it made it then like, I mean, especially his storyline in season two is a lot about like the sort of pitfalls of putting other people before yourself. And I think we wouldn't have had that storyline had it not been for, you know, how he played him in season one.
Had you written jokes in Spanish before you and Julio Torres started writing this show?
No, I had never like done any work in Spanish before. And the scripts, we initially write them in English, knowing that certain dialogue will be said in Spanish and read in English. So there's that process of like, okay, we want it to look funny on screen for people that are reading it. And then, you know, in the back of our heads, we also know how it will be spoken in Spanish. And so we do all the English versions so that the network can read them and understand them. And then there's the Spanish pass. And when I like take a stab at it, like I always need to have Julio, whose Spanish is stronger than mine. Like, you know, we'll look at things together and be like, oh, actually, maybe it should be phrased like this or like that. But yeah, it's a funny kind of way of thinking because we know it'll be said in one language and read in another, and we want both of them to be funny.
It's such an amazing thing about the show, which is probably like 85-90% in Spanish. There's some parts are in English, but it substantially in Spanish with English subtitles on the screen that, you know, subtitled comedy almost never plays because you lose the rhythm of the speech and you lose particularities of the language, all the jokes about puns and so on and so forth. And it plays so beautifully on Los Espookies. It is so funny reading the words. And so what do you have to get right to make that work? Like, what is different about writing a joke and imagining it being read on a subtitle in front of someone speaking in a different language?
I mean, a lot of it, like, the subtitling process for the show is so meticulous because it's not just about, like, you know, we want to phrase this right, but we also want to make sure that the timing of when it appears on screen is good, that if the text is broken up and we're going to see, like, the rest of the sentence on the next, like, screen or whatever, we want it to be broken up in a way where it's like, okay, the joke will be in the second part and not the first part. And so, like, I don't know, it's just a matter of, like, tinkering and finding ways that, like, you know, make us laugh when we read it, because that's how a lot of the audience in the US is going to be experiencing it.
I mean, it also is such a comedy of images and ideas, you know, like, it's full of jokes, but there are no, I don't know, 30 Rock jokes that are a lot of funny words that end in K and two deep cut cultural references. And it's like, here's an interesting idea.
Yeah. Julio and I are not like very pun oriented writers. And so luckily, I mean, I think if we were, the show would not work in two languages like this. And yeah, I think we are more drawn to like ideas that make us laugh. And sometimes they're like very visual things where like reading it is not as important as seeing it. And sometimes it's about like, yeah, the thing that somebody says and making sure that like that looks funny reading.
How do people talk to you about it differently who are watching it in Spanish, so to speak, rather than watching it in English?
I think that for people who are like bilingual, because most people like that grow up outside the U.S. will learn English in school. So I feel like a lot of like my family, at least in Panama, like they all speak English. And so people, I think if you speak both languages, you'll get like certain little jokes, you know, will come across more in Spanish than in the text. Like it's still like funny one way or the other. But I think if someone's bilingual, they will pick up on like a little more things here and there that are like almost like an extra little joke that if you get it in Spanish and you can read it in English, like it just like pays off almost like a little bit better.
Are there any things that you cut from the show because they were too weird?
No, I mean, anything that's cut is because we don't have enough time for it. Like, we haven't ever really had anything come up like that in the writing process where HBO goes like, now, wait a minute, guys, this is too much. Like, they're very, like, hands-off, like, make the show you want to make. And we're, like, I don't feel limited in, like, you know, oh, well, we can't write that because how are we ever going to do that? Like, our production crew down there and our art production designer, Jorge Zambrano, and our wardrobe head, Muriel Parra, are, like, so talented and so funny, and they can, like, do anything. And so it's, like, very fun to write sort of knowing, like, yeah, maybe I don't know exactly how we will shoot an eclipse, but Jorge will figure it out. And he does, you know? So it's like, a very fun and free sort of way to write.
I was very scared that the show wasn't going to get a second season, particularly when after the first season was announced, it got shut down right at the very beginning because of COVID. I wonder if you kind of had if there was any point in there where you had your life flash before your eyes, so to speak, where you were like, look, here I am with my friend. We have two of the most specific comedic sensibilities in all of comedy. We're making this show that is a really beautiful expression of both of them. We may never get this opportunity again.
Well, so after the first season came out in the summer of 2019, we started writing the second season. And we wrote all of the second season in the fall of 2019. And then at the beginning of 2020, we go down to Santiago. We shoot almost 4 full episodes. And then the pandemic starts. So we leave with like 2 episodes and a handful of scenes left. And that was kind of frustrating that like, oh my gosh, we were so close to finishing. Like if we had stayed like 3 more weeks, we would have finished. And so then, you know, we come back here and it's just a waiting game. You know, at that time, everyone's like, oh, maybe in like a month it'll blow over. Obviously, that's not the case. And HBO kept telling us, like, don't worry, you're going to finish. Don't worry, you're going to finish. And so I did have some sort of peace of mind that, like, we will finish. I just didn't know when. And so after 1 year of waiting, like, because we were also dependent on what the COVID protocols in Chile were like. They were a lot more strict than they were here in the U.S. So, like, we couldn't go and shoot the way that people could, you know, shoot after just a couple months in the States. And so, yeah, we were just like, all right, well, I guess we'll hope that cases and things are, like, under control in Chile and that they let, you know, open the border and that we can go back and finish up. And so, yeah, once we hit the like 2-year mark and we got the green light that like everything is like, you know, because there were times where we thought like, okay, now we'll be able to go and we would start planning and then they would roll back their reopening because cases rose. And then it was like, okay, I guess we're waiting again. So yeah, it wasn't like, I didn't think like, man, what if we never finish? I just thought like, what if it's a really long time before we finish? Because I think HBO was like, you know, it's just 2 more episodes. So just go finish it. But yeah, I mean, I know that there were other productions that were just kind of like, that's it, you're done. Sorry if you didn't finish. So I am very grateful that we were able to finish what we started. It felt like it was maybe going to be never ending.
In a broader sense, did you ever have that feeling? Like leaving aside whether you were going to finish the second season, have you had the feeling like, how could I ever get to do something like this again?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't realize how sort of unique the opportunity was that we had. I just kind of thought like, oh yeah, like I got to do a TV show, cool. Like I didn't realize that like, until I started to pitch other projects, that people are going to go like, wait, what? Why is that happening? You know? And it really feels like such a gift to have this show where we can really like write whatever we want and, you know, have the trust from the network in us to like make the show that we want to make. But yeah, I mean, I have times where I'm like, man, is anyone ever going to buy anything else from me? Because everyone thinks it's too niche. You know, that's what my main sort of thing is, like, it's too niche. And I'm like, yeah, but I wish I was more broad, but I'm not. So like, you know, it's going to be niche the way Los Spookies is niche, but it finds its audience.
I'm looking at my imaginary list of questions I was going to ask you, and there's only one left. It says, will Tati be my friend and can we hold hands?
Yeah, Tati will be friends. Although I think Tati is the type of person that if you hold her hand, she's going to think it's romantic.
I mean, I watch the show with my wife, so I think she would understand. Yeah.
In Tati's head, any sort of physical contact with a man is romantic. That's how Tati moves through the world. It's like, yeah, she's not someone to like flirt with if you're not ready to jump into something serious.
Well, Ana Fábrega, I'm so grateful to you for coming on the show. I just couldn't be a bigger fan of Los Spookies and of your work. I'm so happy I got to talk to you.
Thank you so much. It's so nice talking with you. And yeah, thank you for having me.
Ana Fábrega, folks. You can stream both seasons of Los Spookies on HBO Max, and you absolutely should. It is so fantastic. I will tell you this. I texted a very snobby comedy writer friend of mine the other day. Hey, are you watching Los Spookies? And he texted me back, yes, that is the only comedy show that makes me laugh. Los Spookies. It rules. You don't have to be a weird snob either. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is created from the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Greater Los Angeles, California. My house was built in 1888, and I think it is safe to assume it is haunted. But I just want to let ghosts know that I am super cool and chill about ghosts and really pro-ghost, and they shouldn't freak me out. Not because I'm scared of them. It's not that I'm scared of them. It's just that they should know that I'm super chill and I'm on their side. And they shouldn't scare me. Our show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Our producers are Jesus Ambrosio and Richard Roby. Our production fellow at Maximum Fun is Tabitha Myers. We get booking help from Merritt Davis. Our interstitial music is by DJW, also known as Dan Wally. Our theme song is called Huddle Formation. It was written and recorded by the Go Team. Thanks to them and Memphis Industries, their label, for providing it. Bullseye is also on YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook. Find us there, follow us, and we'll share with you all of our interviews. And I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sell without needing to code or design. Just bring your best ideas and Shopify will help you open up shop. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR.
This message is brought to you by NPR sponsor, Lisa, in collaboration with West Elm. Discover the new natural hybrid mattress, expertly crafted from natural latex and certified safe foams, designed with your health and the planet in mind. Visit leesa.com to learn more.
On It's Been a Minute, we're keeping you in the know when it comes to culture. I break down the latest trends and the forces behind them, and introduce you to the creatives who think deeply about how we live today. Come for some good old cultural analysis and have a few laughs with me. Listen to the It's Been a Minute podcast from NPR.